So we're about to hit M1, and one of the things that's important that I learned is that we need to get the JIRA stuff in place. So Tony's got the JIRA ticket, and I had linked to the architecture link, I think. Let me see. Yeah. So yesterday I put the link to the architecture review JIRA. And one thing we do need to do, Tony, is to create tickets for our sub and non-test, probably non-test only things. So for example, and this just lets the PTLs know, basically. Obviously we don't need one for this. So really we just need one, I think, in SDNC, CC SDK or SDNC. And I learned how to do that. So let me just make the one here. So basically you need to find CC SDK, create a story, and I'll let you fill in the details, but basically it's basically CNPS and R7 CSDK work. So basically you just got to fill in details here of what we're doing. I guess you can just cut and paste this stuff, I suppose.
Yeah, fair enough. Or you can do it as soon as you're there.
yeah, that's pretty easy. Okay. It's for Guilin. Should be a CCSDK in here somewhere. And then you epic link to the req322, which is our req, click on it, and then create. And this will automatically link this story to this req. So if we refresh control R, we'll see that it's linked to CCSDK2443. And I don't think we need any other ones, but if we do, that's basically
the virtual test, yeah.
Yeah, that's how you make them. So this will, I think, clear us for this, and I think we're good otherwise in this dashboard here. So that's probably the most pressing thing. Another thing in the news is R6 has completed. So yesterday at the TSC, they voted that R6 passes. And let me just show you really quick the presentation of the release thing here. Let me see, where is it? Here it is, okay. So these were the slides that were shown at the TSC yesterday, and I know not everybody was at the TSC, so they talked about the marketing plan and that they signed off yesterday, so the 18th. There's a marketing update, and basically there'll be a Linux Foundation webinar series. There's a link here for key release updates, which I put in the 5G notes yesterday. Brandon Wick is orchestrating this marketing update, and then there was a project lifecycle discussion. Okay, and then one other thing before we turn this over to Tony is the virtual face-to-face coming up in a couple weeks' time. If you haven't registered, I suggest that you register. But another important thing is that there's actually a survey going out because they have too many presentations. Topics. There are too many topics that have been, which is a good thing, I guess. There's a lot of interesting talks that have been proposed. There's a survey up that asks people to vote on the topics. Let me see if let me find the link to that before we, you know what, I'll find the link to it while you're presenting. And so you probably want to go to that link and vote, basically. So we have the CNPS and the model-driven POC has a chance to get in there. Yeah, okay. All right, so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Tony. Go ahead. He's going to talk about the talk here.
Okay, let's see if I can share the screen. Give me a new thing for me. So I select that and I click share. And hopefully you can all see your names. Move that away. Can you see my screen?
Yeah, we can see your screen. Yeah.
Excellent. So it's my first time sharing with Zoom. Apologies if I'm a little bit tentative. Okay, so first I want to have a disclaimer on this. This is very much a work in progress. Now, we want to be collaborative in how we approach this problem space. We don't want to have this as an Ericsson thing that's just being deployed on top of OMAP and we be the only people interested or working in it. So we want to go through, and this is very much early thinking in terms of the design analysis. So it's a level below. There's lots and lots of information in here, and I'm sure that we're not going to cover it all. I will post the slides, and I'm hoping for some good discussion as we go through this and over the next several weeks, and possibly even with some different meetings as well. So that's just to put this presentation in context. It's not a done deal. Absolutely not. It's just a straw man, so we can kick it over. We can discuss ideas, look at alternatives. Everything is still on the table because essentially no decisions have been made yet. Is that understood?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay. So first of all, a little bit of background or revision. This is a proposal for a POC. It's primarily around, I'm going to put up my pointer, pen. Yeah, the laser would have probably been better. So it's primarily around the configuration management, at least to begin with. It's not exclusively so, but the POC is aiming first and foremost at that. It's also looking at the current view of the network state. There is, in our project proposal, a whole bunch of information around historical. And I will have more on that later in the slides if we get to it. But this has very significant differences, as we've mentioned in our discussions around historical versus current previously in this meeting, that there are lots of different characteristics, both in terms of performance and access patterns and lifecycle, all sorts of different things that drive these to be different. Our focus is very much on the current view, so model-driven of the current view. But we are trying to be aware of and understand how that will impact the historical view. So there's a balance between the analysis and what we're trying to achieve in a POC in the first pass. We expect to start the CCSDK project and the interfaces that are within the CCSDK project for the existing in order to try and provide some level of migration or to, as far as possible, ease that migration. The proof points, read-write operations, to deploy upgrade Yang fragments, to demonstrate model-driven behavior of the configuration and parameter service, and obviously to provide some architecture and vision with a view towards essentially providing seed code in the H timeframe. Okay, that's very quick revision. Next. The timing and resourcing, the very preliminary plan is where we are now, June 2nd to July the 24th. That's what we're doing right now, the technical analysis and architectural planning. We want to kind of have a deadline for this so that we can present at least the first draft, more than draft, the first solid direction at the DDF. So when we present to the DDF, we want to have a much more complete version of these slides. We're also in the process of ramping up developers. Ericsson are looking to put three people in, one of whom you've already known, Tuan. The Tuan is on leave at the moment, unfortunately. Then in line with the G release, now this is just a projection, July 24th, we will have iterative project development or POC development until that point. And then somewhere towards the end of the summer, we'd look to begin to engage with the TSC and potentially even the architecture again in terms of actually getting more support for a standalone project in the H release. Again, very preliminary. Next. Okay, so the POC steps. Define and target architecture and then create initial code framework. A generic schema doesn't necessarily have to be SQL, but a very generic schema to begin our service provider interface. The transforms for Yang. So Yang is a very, very capable language. It has an awful lot of syntax. It has an awful lot of constructs. And it can be difficult and daunting if you take them all on at the first pass. And we don't want to do that. We want to do this iteratively. We want to be able to write data based on the subset, the selected subset of the Yang language, and to be able to see that in the database. So once we're able to look in the back end of the database, we will essentially pass this. Then we want to be able to read from the database. So then can we reproduce a Yang fragment or a document based on information that we had previously stored in the database? And then we want to start the validation of input. So when somebody puts in a Yang document or however that API looks, and there's more of that later in the slides, this is the start of the API definition. What does that input look like and how do we validate it? And this is also related to types of transformers that we have for each of the different aspects of the Yang language. And then we do this iteratively. Here's a simple graphic representing exactly the same words. And so we start off with Yang language features, so the simple primitives and parent-child relationships, so paths essentially, references, different types of paths, and augmentation, which is when we start getting into the more friendly or difficult or challenging aspects of Yang. So we create a mapping for each of these features in the language. We update the schema if and as it's required. We update the API and the SPI, and then we wait for another piece of language support. So we iterate through this loop. And ultimately, what we would like to be able to do in the Guilin release, if we get so far, is to, in a backwardly compatible way, contribute to any ready or code interfaces to the CC SDK. And then if we're not ready for the Guilin release and the H release, push it towards a standalone project. So that's the basic approach. Okay, Sean, work for me. Any questions on that before I get into the more technical stuff? I wanted to skim through that very quick. Okay, gone. Whew. So again, very preliminary work coming up. Open to discussion. Please interrupt me as we go. So this is a diagram that's meant to be somewhat in line with the architectural description diagrams that we get for the configuration of persistency services sitting in the middle, and it's interacting with applications, SDC for the ingestion of models, controllers for the ingestion of data and or models, and a state reader for the delegation of the reading of volatile information from the XNFs, and one or more database management systems.
Tony?
Yes?
Yeah, so I've actually done quite a lot of work in streaming time series and temporal databases. I don't think that you're quite discussing that part the right way. I can provide a discussion of it at, say, the next meeting.
Yeah, absolutely, that would be welcome.
Okay.
And I kind of do want to get to that in about four slides time. I want to get to exactly that problem. So it might well be good to have this discussion. I mean, this is part of the discussion. I don't think this diagram for the time series is good at all. I think this is quite bad.
Yeah. There's some very positive, some very good alternatives. I'll put together a quick presentation for next week.
Excellent. Thanks, Ted. Look forward to it. Okay, so one of the nice things about these C4 diagrams is that you get to see a little bit of information about the relationships. So the mirror service, for example, is using the CRUD access over a REST interface to talk to the configuration persistency service. again, none of this stuff is set in stone. It's all proposal and very early thinking, get something on paper and then modify it. Okay. So this is basic context. Now, when we drill down or drill into this, and I hope you can read this, so first of all, I want to bring us through the model. So the model repo, everything has to be modeled, because this is the POC is about how do we drive the addition of new models and how do we drive the behavior of the configuration of persistency using models. Okay, so the model repo has an interface for lifecycle management of models, so that the controllers, for example, after discovering a new XNF or being told about a new XNF that supports the delivery of models, can actually propagate that model directly to the model repo, which can then be taken by the configuration and parameter service and loaded. Similarly, the model repo will be listening to DMAP for the deployment of new CSARs, and then it will pick up any relevant models from that CSAR and again deploy them or make them available to the configuration and parameter service. So that much is fairly straightforward. It's an entity that is responsible solely for the lifecycle management and storage of models. Okay. If I skip on then to page
just a quick question. Have you thought about the external sort of UI? Which things have APIs and swaggers that will give access to outside components? Is that
I do, and that would be this CRUD data access and the notification API.
Okay.
And the model access lifecycle management. So these are all interfaces that will be defined. And here I call them, they're REST. I haven't actually put it on this. I've not annotated that line, which is a omission. It should be tagged as REST, as should these two.
I see. Okay, thanks.
Okay, this one. This one's not. This is Kafka encapsulation. So it's a different format, different technology. Okay. Same diagram. Now I'm looking at your question. The CRUD and the REST of the main interfaces are using inside here a library component. So the library is where we see the heart of the business logic or the intelligence or the algorithms of the configuration persistency service. Okay, and then this, a lot of what we expect in ONAP is that ONAP will want, and many of the users of the configuration parameters for service will want to see a REST interface for the CRUD operations against the database. But for characteristics reasons, and this is some of the questions that were raised at the TSC, and there's a different deployment view in a couple of slides, where the configuration persistency service as a library is co-deployed with something that wants to use it for high throughput, high volume data. Okay, and that gets rid of an awful lot of latency because you do not have to serialize, transport, and deserialize data unnecessarily. Obviously, there is some serialization of data and deserialization and possibly reserialization of data as you move it through the SPI and down to the database management system. Okay, any questions on the exposure? Because I think that was your question, Ben.
Yes, thanks.
Yeah, the detail of what those things look like as well, I have questions over, and those are decisions that we'll have to make, whether those are object-orientated or behavior-orientated interfaces, and what the payload will be, or if the payload will be incorporated in the URIs for the REST interfaces. So we have some work to do there in terms of bringing people along, educating people, and discussing and making decisions. Okay, the SPI, very important part of the whole architecture of this thing. This is something that I think will probably remain in some form. So this is a service provider interface And here we have an OLTP data store plugin, which is providing an interface. So this could be MariaDB, it could be PostgreSQL, PostgreSQL, it could be Oracle, it could be a proprietary database, it could be, we don't mind. We want to have that level of abstraction where we're able to plug in different implementations, different backends for the data store. So the configuration and persistency service should be working against an SPI. Any questions on the SPI? Otherwise, I'm going to dive straight into where Ted jumped at the beginning. Okay, so the DLMS is something that is triggered. And here I have it triggered based on an invocation. So when the CPS is invoked, it looks at the model or understands the model that the data lifecycle management service should be invoked as a result of something, of it having done something. So an attribute has changed or a model has been updated, and it now needs to tell the data lifecycle management that that has happened. And then it's the responsibility of the data lifecycle management to invoke the time series data. So this is one approach, and it was my first pass. And I looked at it and I said, this is ugly. This is not nice. This makes it quite coupled. And I think I put in a slide on why. So this is a discussion slide. So my first thing, it's nice. It is a nice thing, and this is where I was coming from. So we have a single CRUD interface, and then I update an object or an attribute. And as a result of decoration, for want of a better word, on the model, I realize as CPS that this needs additional handling. So I then forward that change to the DLMS, and then it goes off and writes it to a historical data store. And everybody's happy, because here's the change that happened that the historical data store cared about. And it happened transparently to everybody. So nobody had to understand that additional behavior was required. They just dropped in the model to say, I'm interested in any changes to a particular piece of information. Send it to the historical data store when it happens. And then that's fine, but then what happens when you want to read that information from the time series database? So the API design for a time series database is very, very different to the API design of a current or an OLTP, online transaction protocol database. They're just sufficiently different that really they need a different interface. I mean, do you clutter the original interface with time bounds from and to, and then expect them to be null? That's kind of ugly for maybe where we want to concentrate on first. It's ugly because you're just dropping nulls in. So then maybe you've got a second interface. Now, if you've got a second interface, then you're kind of making the benefit of having a single thing do everything. It's kind of not so good anymore. You're challenging the benefits. The benefits aren't very great. Then the configuration persistency service is not likely to be the only source of these write operations. Historical data typically deals with, and this is where I think Ted is coming from, the streaming. So PM data, event data, probe data, counter data, KPIs. This is typically what is stored in time series databases, because something that changes on a regular basis that you want to track over time. So it's not normally configuration. Configuration is something that can be used to enrich the PM or analytical data. So the use cases are different. The model lifecycle management also becomes trickier if we're using these models.
Just a quick question about, as I think about the historical store thing. Is that meant to be within the core? I think, didn't we talk about sort of a separate database too for that, or is that a more?
Yep, we do, and that's why I have a separate database here.
Okay, I see.
Okay, and this is a pod. So these things I'm saying are deployed together as a single unit from a Kubernetes perspective.
I see.
But these are microservices. I already had some separation in here. But the question is that separation enough? And I'm inclined to think not. From a characteristics perspective, from a scale perspective, it's quite difficult to scale things that have different characteristics in the same pod, because you can only scale the pod with Kubernetes. So if you mix too many different things in the one pod, you get a whole load of dead space. If you have to scale this one, then you're also scaling these things, even though they might not necessarily need to be scaled. So that's one good reason why this level, a tight coupling here is a bad idea. And I don't have it in here, but that is another reason why this type level of coupling would be bad.
Okay, I think it's interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to finish running through this slide because I was talking about the model lifecycle management. If I have a piece of data and my historical data store is reliant on the model to interpret that data, then when can I remove that model? So it's much easier with the current database. If I have a model that describes part of an XNF, and all instances of that XNF are gone, then I'm now in a position, if I want to remove that model. Whereas if I have a retention period, then how long do, it significantly complicates the lifecycle management of models. Okay, it's just, I don't want to have to deal with that complexity. So I don't think any of us want to deal with that complexity, actually, having seen it in the past. Once bitten, twice shy. But I don't want to go into it other than, unless someone asks me a very explicit question, you get into trouble when you have lots of models that you're unable to delete. You're going to run into a different type of scale problem. And the solution, which is what I'm trying to indicate with my big black arrow here, is that it's a separation of concerns. So if we provide loose coupling, so not a direct invocation by REST, but using notifications that possibly and more than likely are configured by the model, so the CTS is not emitting changes for every change, not emitting notifications for every change, but only for those changes that have been marked as relevant to something else in the system. And what that means is that you don't get an implicit read access or any desire for an implicit read access to historical data store. Okay, and yes, here I've moved it outside. So the deployment, it's not in the pod anymore, it's somewhere else. And the communication that we use is over DMAP, so notification based on model. The plugin is gone. I'm removing the need for an SPI or for the same SPI, because again, I didn't think that was a particularly good idea. So this is really my first pass and my first discussion point is, what does this forum think of the level of coupling between the CPS and the data lifecycle management, i.e. the time series data in this case, but it's not necessarily limited to time series. It could be other types of data repository or even physical location of data. So I mean, we have requirements for a distributed CPS. We may want to move data from the edge of the network to the core of the network for analytic purposes, but to do that in batches when the network is quiet, because we may be competing for O&M bandwidth. You know, just as a practical concern, that's the kind of thing that this data lifecycle management service can help with.
So if you're asking, will some or should some of the analytics at the edge be computed and the end results of that analysis be sent, I would say that's a good idea rather than sending all the raw data, because why are we having all this processing at the edge of this capability at the edge if we're not going to use it and just throw it into a central region for analysis and then try to do it when things are not so busy and hence lose the real-time aspects of that data and being able to act upon it. I would say, yeah, that's we should do some of that processing, but I'm not clear on how you're breaking things up with modeling and so on. I'm still trying to understand what your conclusion is here. As long as we are able to understand what kind of performance changes have happened that are critical and what kind of configuration changes have happened during that time. And that's been captured in some kind of a time series database. And there again, we don't need all the configuration information, just deltas, right? So we can correlate the two. But I'm a little lost, quite frankly, because I haven't been fully engaged in this discussion because I'm parallel processing. But I guess... have we captured requirements somewhere or user stories? Because it looks like you're doing this detailed design, and I'm not sure if there's a mapping into requirements or user stories. I'm a little lost, quite frankly.
Yeah, my source of information is our project proposal.
Fred. So I would say our project proposal, which we spent about a half year on, is basically the basis of our requirements, which is basically the team has taken time to specify what we expect out of this, and they're effectively our requirements. I'll put a link of the project proposal.
Okay. Yeah. I'm in and out of this group, so I don't have visibility into the latest.
Yep. And
it's evolving too. I mean, I think as we get more detail here, we can always, of course, get more refinement in the requirements too.
No, I understand, but I don't have a good, that's my problem. I don't have a good snapshot of what you're working towards. Obviously, you're deep in the weeds on implementation.
Okay, can I pull up to the forest and look down from the clouds just for a second and try to square some of your questions, Fred? Okay, so we want this to be model-driven. So we want to be able to store data that's coming from a heterogeneous set of network functions, so that can be used by applications within the ONAP space. Mm-hmm. So we want to be able to do this at runtime. So we want first and foremost, we're looking at configuration data. So then the question is, how do you take a standard IT database, so in this case, the OLTP data store, and store data in it that it has absolutely no idea, and we have no idea at the time of designing of that schema, what the data will be. So how do we take information that has been defined by standards or defined by vendors or defined by service design and support applications in the persistence of that? So what we want to do is, yeah.
No, I was just going to say, shouldn't we try to take an approach rather than boil the ocean and say, okay, within ONAP, or service and resource orchestration, what are the parameters that are going to be controlled for configuration of different VNFs for their lifecycle management, and use that set first rather than worry about every configuration parameter that's in the universe, I guess.
We're not trying to do that, but what we're trying to say is that we accept that there will be any number coming forward. And if we went with this default subset, which is what we have done in the OR6 release. So the configuration and persistency service in the OR6 release is looking at just a very, very small subset of parameters configuration that is relevant to the SON use case. But that's going to grow.
Right.
And then the interface that we would have there is going to be insanely large. And that's not scalable from a development perspective or a maintenance perspective. So the approach that we have taken is that we would like to see this as model driven. And by making it model driven, you start with one model, and once you can handle one model, you can handle N models.
Okay, so it sounds like you're already on that path. That's good. I get it. All right. That's good information.
Okay. So that's the first definition of model driven. So we'd like to take models from SDC design or the XNFs and be able to make those models available at runtime without having to redeliver any of the configuration of persistency service software to applications, so they can store and read and reason over data that has been stored on their behalf. The second aspect of the model driven is the things like access control, things like handling, where we do not want to emit notifications. If we're getting a stream of events, those notifications are already on the on DMAP. So there are events coming through some kind of a DMAP channel. So any participant in ONAP can already take those and deal with them. What we would like to be able to do is to then say, when an event comes in and we're going to persist it, we're going to update our current transactional data store. But we understand, because of the model has been updated to say that somebody else in ONAP is particularly interested when something has been stored in the database. So say one of these events or a particular subset of these events is interested or is interesting to a time series or historical data, then we put an additional notification on to DMAP and say, now you can do what you like with this. We've been told to do this. So our behavior, this configuration of parameter service behavior, has been updated to emit a change notification under certain circumstances. And in this case, some of the circumstances are types of data that have been defined by a model. So subsets of the data that are stored. Perfect. And that then allows something like the data lifecycle management to do its thing.
Yes.
Similarly, if the SDC comes along, some designer in SDC says this is relevant, this new piece of information is relevant, but I don't want anybody writing to it except one component in ONAP. So now we're getting into access control. So and this is something I don't know if it can be done elegantly or well, but it's definitely something that we talked about in the project proposal. How do we do role-based or access control of data in the configuration and persistency service? And this is quite important when you have a common information model, and that was one of the questions that was raised at the TSC. And we do have to understand exactly how we can police it, and if it's possible to police it comprehensively, or if we have to rely on convention. So this is a discussion point for a later deep dive.
Well, I clearly see the need for data governance, but aren't there mechanisms? I mean, this is really a master data management problem that we're addressing, right? But there aren't there efforts that cover that somewhere in this or other SDOs? I mean, this is a well understood topic, right? Why are we struggling with reinventing the wheel for data governance?
I would love to see some of those papers and some of those solutions.
Yeah, let's just look up master data management, and there's a whole science behind what we're doing here that has been established, and there are vendor products that do that. Master data management, that's essentially what
I will look that up. And that's why we're here. This is a straw man.
I get that. But I think there are aspects that you just discussed where we're reinventing the wheel, which is okay. But there's a huge science behind, a mature science behind what we're discussing here. It's just a use case.
So either we can beg, borrow, or steal a wheel.
Yeah.
It's already there. That's cool. Or if we can beg, borrow, and steal the science behind the new wheel. If we can't find a wheel that's round enough for us.
Right. No, I'm glad you took this 50,000 foot view, because it helped me to see what we're focusing on a little bit better. But, all right, so master data management, that's our homework assignment to get smart on that. There's a lot of information that can be leveraged in that, and solutions are out there. Some are open source and so on.
I know this is a challenging problem in this space. So if there's something that I'm not aware of, then I'm very happy to go with.
Okay.
Right.
I have a question.
So, go ahead.
Yeah, Tony. Hi, this is Shankar. I should also apologize. I have not been able to keep up. I joined these calls a little bit halfway. One clarification I wanted was the pod for CPS, which is running in the environment. The actual data that comes in, for example, from the West collector and the DMAP notifications, so am I interpreting it right? All of that is that little circle on the top, the DMAP notifications, and that comes into CPS?
Yes. That's one possible deployment. There's another deployment in a moment.
Okay. But those DMAP notifications from the network have nothing to do with all the stuff in the bottom, right? Because you mentioned something could be deployed in the edge, time series, data, and things like that. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. The one is purely about how do I get data in. So it's a very specific part of a larger use case. If there is a change notification or a piece of information, a spontaneous event coming from the network, how is that propagated and persisted? And then the model-driven aspect of it, if we have a new spontaneous event type, how do we persist that without having to update the schema in the database management system, i.e. have downtime or an upgrade process?
Okay, so is it accurate to say the top part of this picture is data streaming in and getting into CPS, and the bottom part is all about the models and the schemas and how do you?
It's not quite that rigorous. Diagrams were done based on what fit on the A4 piece of paper that I was printing it on. So it's not quite as rigorous as you'd hope, Shankar. Apologies for that.
No. I like the notion when you had about separation of concerns, but I was not fully sure what are the two things that are being separated. I heard CPS and the DLMS, and I'm trying to just get a handle on whether the DLMS actually deals with live data streams or only with models.
In this case, yeah. The DLMS would be dealing with a stream of notifications that are coming from the CPS. And the CPS would be emitting those notifications based on a model that it had been configured with. So it wouldn't emit a notification for every change that happened in the database or every change that it was making. It would only emit those changes for those things that it had been configured to do. And that configuration would be given by a model which would be loaded at runtime.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to make a slightly separate comment, maybe not immediately, but let me mention it now. At some point, it would be nice to see which of these are needed absolutely to get started with something simple and which modules come later. Because, for example, we absolutely need a pod in CPS with something with a little database. And maybe
correct.
Initially, the schema is static, but it's done in a way which can be model-driven, and the model-driven aspects, some of them will come later. Right?
Yeah, and that will come. I'm just not there yet. For me, I like to think about a problem, and it's I'm very much an architect. I've been an architect in Ericsson for longer than I should care to admit. So I'm a big fan of upfront development. I see nothing but trouble when emergent design arises, and I see Agile as the biggest license. Agile is fantastic, but it's also an incredible license for people who give themselves to do emergent design, and they get into so much trouble, and then they don't have the bandwidth to refactor because things move on. So then they have to recreate. So I'm a big fan of upfront design. So for my personal analysis processes, to think about as much of a problem as I can, but to time box it. So that's why we have a time frame on this. We want to have something ready to run with in time for the DDF, where we hope to garner support from other members of the community so that we can actually get into the implementation with more than just the three Ericsson guys who are going to start working on this, who have already started. One who has already started within this team.
Understood. Understood. That's why we are here discussing. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're helping me with the analysis, and I'm helping you understand part of the problem space. It sounds like you have your head around it anyway. Okay.
Thanks.
So the separation of concerns seems to be accepted. Ted, you made a comment earlier about wanting to present something next week about streaming. So streaming to time series database. This isn't quite streaming to time series.
Well, so actually, what I was going to say is you should be thinking in terms of a different kind of technology called a temporal database rather than a time series database.
Okay.
And I can make a presentation which puts these things into context. Shankar is familiar with this work.
At a high level, what's the difference between a temporal and a time series? And when you're talking about time series, it's just a streaming storage of streaming data that you would get from like a CNCF package, like FileBeat or something, right?
So usually what you're the target application for a time series database is if you have a collection of KPIs, which might or might not be streamed to you. It's not that critical.
True.
But you have this a series of measurements, which are either point measurements or over a nice well-defined period of time. And then you want to add them up in various ways. So, you know, what was my average download speed or something like that? What was my maximum utilization over a certain time period?
Yeah, but it's basically a peak key value pair storage of time series data.
Well, I can make a presentation which goes into a little bit more.
Well, what's the delta? Oh, just at a high level.
So the difference is that the time series database talks about these events that occur. And these events have a well-defined point of occurrence or a well-defined time of occurrence. So, you know, a measurement over a five-minute period. Whereas a temporal database talks about a condition that persists over a duration of time. So that from Monday through Friday, the link between router A and router B was 10 gigabits a second. And then on Friday at 2 o'clock, it got upgraded to 100 gigabits a second.
Okay, so they're complementary, or one is a negative of the other. They're different views of the same information.
And one thing is that this is actually a very common technology. It's available in Postgres and it's available in MariaDB. And you, because of that, you don't actually need two different databases.
It just seems like it's analytics that they're calculated on the time series. Is that
if you want to calculate analytics on a time series, and that's specifically what you want to do, then you probably want a time series database. But if you want to know what was the state of something in the past, you probably want to use a temporal database. And it seems to me that what we're talking about here is trying to identify states in the past and try to identify changes in the states in the past.
Yes.
So this is very well addressed by a temporal database.
Okay.
And you're saying that MariaDB is an example of such an implementation.
So MariaDB has it built in. There is a Postgres extension which will implement it. I've used it. You get the current view and the in the past view transparently.
That's great. That's really great.
So as I said, I'll make a presentation about this, and hopefully I can clear up some of this confusion. But basically,
that's perfect. That's actually. That sounds exactly what we're trying to do. Okay.
Yeah. So actually, this can be made really a lot simpler, and I think that's the one of the key takeaways.
Excellent.
Can I just comment? I'm sort of underscoring what Ted Johnson said, but maybe in different words. He's my database reference expert go-to person, and we have actually looked at this problem over, actually, it's a few years by now. And so the way I think about it, a time series database is, yes, if you have lots of events, you have lots of counters coming in and you want to keep track, you want to do averages, what was the throughput in every 5-minute window and number of alarms. And so if you're doing time series analysis, or typical KPI analysis, then use a time series database. When we got into this configuration space, it was more like, I don't really want to know how many updates came in the last 1 hour. I really want to know what changed and when. And without And so in a simpler way to state the problem is, without pulling all the data for the last 6 hours to figure out what changed, is there a simple way to just to say, at this point in time, what was the configuration? And someone please calculate like? The deltas. And so Ted actually came up with that way of looking at, which is, if that's what you want to do, then don't use a time series database, use this other thing that he has worked on.
And not only so do we want to at some point do it for the configuration, in the future, we also want to do it for state, capturing state information. And that's something we can talk about later. So this sounds like the right
So when he presents in detail, that you'll get a good feel for that.
Oh, that's really good. Now, something I could say here is that both of those use cases are completely valid, and I wouldn't see them as being mutually exclusive. And where we decide to store things is very much dependent on the time budget we have in the use case that we're trying to execute. And this goes for both the location. We had that conversation earlier, where we have data at the edge and we have data in the central servers. But it also goes for how much processing you would have to change one view from a temporal to a time series or a time series to a temporal. So you may well take the cost of duplicating the data in order to minimize the time it takes to execute that query. So they're not mutually exclusive. And that's one of the things that I'm hoping that this design helps. So if the underlying database technology supports a temporal aspect, then there is no need for a separate temporal database. But if you do still want to do the analytics and have that information ready to go in an analytics perspective, where you can do those slice and dice calculations, then you may still want to feed it as quickly as possible to that repository.
Yeah, so and it depends on what type of data you're referring to, if it's actionable or you need to do long-term trends on it. But a configuration temporal database isn't that expensive to send northbound to a central system. The performance data is, and that's why I was saying aggregation and local. In fact, it could even be, once you are doing the analysis locally, you can make the changes locally, right? That's a local optimum. Then you can report the findings, and there can be a global optimum loop around that local lifecycle management loop to change it further, right, or to trend it. So we got to push more of the smarts and that database towards the edge, make it compact and so forth. But the findings and changes have to be sent centrally. And all right, I think we're on the same page.
Excellent. So we're having a good discussion. We're okay with decoupling. Ted's going to present something next week around temporal and time series. And that could simplify, at the very least, temporal. So OLTP with temporal capabilities in this diagram, which is all good. So I'm hearing absolutely no objections to keeping loose coupling between this data lifecycle management and the configuration and persistency service. Neither am I hearing a massive objection to the idea that we do have a data lifecycle management service, which can then be used to update something else. It doesn't have to be a time series database or a temporal database. It could be something else entirely.
So Tony, another question. So in this picture, where is the database which has the configuration information? Is it the?
Is this one the OLTP data store?
That one. Okay.
Yeah.
And OLTP.
Yeah, that's the use case that we're concentrating on first. Sorry, go ahead.
Correct. So that's what online transaction. What's the OLTP?
Online transactional protocol. Yeah.
Okay.
And transaction boundaries are another question that we have to talk and discuss about. But that's for another day. There's quite a few, and I will post these slides, and then maybe we'll have a regular session for discussing these things, if that's all right with Ben during this meeting.
So just from an architectural perspective, so the boundary you have written, which is the pod for CPS,
You're
using the term pod because it's a Kubernetes pod, right? That's what you meant? So that pod doesn't really have a database by itself. It's talking to another pod with the database.
That was how I drew it, yeah. It could well be that we have a database management system within the pod, and then the pod has got a requirement on persistent storage. Okay. This is another choice that we have to make.
So I agree. I would just consider that when we read out this picture to show at least the fact that that OLTP database is part of CPS, because I think of CPS as, yes, it's a service, but it's providing data, and so what goes into the first, and it could be a module with two pods or one pod with two containers. It could be more. I've seen implementations where there is this, like you said, there is a pod that handles the transactions, and then the database is in a different container. Sometimes it's two containers in the same pod, sometimes two different pods as a module, but they go together.
Yep, understood. And it's a good, I get the comment, I like it. It's a good clarification, and it will make this easier to explain. But and it is a question that has been raised as well. The database management system is part of CPS, and the database schema is part of DPS.
Okay,
Glenn, I've used up most of the time.
That's fine. This is good. So are there any other questions? That we are pretty much at time. Are there any other questions or actions you want to note from anybody? It's really good, Tony. I think this is excellent.
We didn't get very far. There's about 40 odd slides on this deck.
And
we got to the discussion that I wanted to get to today.
So sure, we can continue. Yeah, right. No, this is perfect. I like it. Okay. So anyway, we are at pretty much at time though. So I suggest maybe next week, Ted, do you want to maybe continue this, and then Ted can also talk?
I think let's take Ted first, because this thread is going to go on. I mean,
for a while, yeah.
I have the standalone deployment, and then I have talks about the generic schema. So this is an example of what we might do for a generic schema and why. We can have a long discussion around that. The design of the CRUD, we talk about targets, what are the X and Fs, how do we manage that, what do we need to think across from ANAI, model deployments. So there's a lot of information here. What do we need to look at first? The now stuff, the augmentation, and so the notes from the previous meeting. And then I have a whole bunch of brainstorming around what do the interfaces look like, the model access, lifecycle management, the SPI, all this kind of stuff is. And I want to do this with, I'll be doing this myself. I'll be doing this with Tuan and the other Ericsson guys, I think, when they're allocated to this project. But I also want to do it with the community, because we need to bring people along. So there's a lot of stuff in here that has to happen in the community. And I would like us to take a section or part of this meeting every week to elaborate and discuss this implementation details, at least until the end of June, when we have the user forum.
Is there a way we could break this diagram down and simplify it so that we can just focus on the configuration? It just will make it all more streamlined. I think we may be able to move faster if we could do that. I'm wondering, think about how we could focus on capturing the configuration changes from the network functions and just building that basis.
And we will, but I also think that we have to consider how the other parts are going to work, because otherwise you're going to run into,
as long as you realize that that's going to change, that's going to be the agile part, right? I agree with what you're saying, but
Right. And a POC is meant to be agile, but we still need to actually prove the architecture in that. So we also have a desire to engage with the modeling guys and the architecture team to ensure that we're not doing anything in terms of interactions with the rest of ONAP, that we are introducing model-driven or these aspects of model-driven in a correct and formal way and an agreed way.
True.
So yeah, I hear what you're saying, and we will definitely have an agile POC development, and it'll be quite iterative. And hopefully every 2 to 3 weeks we'll have something new to show in the CM space. But I reiterate, I'm an architect.
Just the picture. Mirror service alone is an interesting part. How we're going to implement that in a model-driven fashion and open it up so that what are going to be the components of that? Will there be some CNCF components that are in a library that are being called by an external entity or pushed from the XNF itself? I mean, that is a foundational part of how we're going to do this cost effectively, yes, right? And so, all right.
That's the full use case, which absolutely has to make sense. But the piece that I want to concentrate on is the CPS. For me, the ability to get information from the network is an input to how do I store that data in a model-driven way? How do I react to and behave? How do I make my behavior adaptable based on the desires of the SDC user? How do I react differently to different types of data, different pieces of information, different scenarios?
Yeah, we have to capture that up front at the designer level so it can be used in the model, in the different components and the policies that are going to be pushed into those components to do that work.
Yeah, for me, the use case is provide the context for the environment in which the CPS has to execute. And I want to concentrate on the CPS in that context. So I do hear what you're saying, and yes, ultimately we will have to streamline it, but that's what the page up.
We have to do a top-down and bottom-up approach at the same time, I guess.
Correct.
That's
the
point. All right.
Thanks, Ben, for holding on.
Okay, guys, thank you so much for staying a few minutes over. We'll continue this definitely in the upcoming weeks. Okay, great. Thank you, everybody. Have a great day.
Thanks. Bye.
Stay safe.